I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, 1963 stands as a pivotal year in the civil rights movement. The year witnessed the assassination of Medgar Evers, a prominent NAACP leader, and the violent bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. It was also the year of the historic March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his iconic I Have a Dream speech. The Birmingham campaign led by King brought national attention to the brutality of segregation, and these events galvanized public opinion and forced the Kennedy administration to propose sweeping civil rights legislation. 1963 set the stage for the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and marked a moral and political awakening in American society. Peniel Joseph is the author of the book Freedom Season, How 1963 Transformed America's Civil Rights Revolution. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The flaw of learning history is the illusion of inevitability of events. We already know the outcome. In this case, we already know that the Civil Rights Act was passed, the Voting Rights Act was passed, and there was a success with the fight for civil rights in America, and that there would be assassinations and more bloodshed to get there. We already know the spoiler. So if we really want to understand that struggle of the movement, then we have to try to put that knowledge away. To think about the civil rights struggle, think about it like modern day struggles. So we have no idea what's going to happen in America's near future with, for example, efforts to preserve civil rights or immigration and other confounding issues. So consider being in 1963. America is deeply divided over what was called, in the words of that day, the race problem, with a lot of Negro protests, an integration crisis, civil rights controversies. These terms were often used to suggest public disagreement without directly addressing the central issues of government-sponsored injustice or gross economic inequality for African Americans. But things were starting to change at that time. But there wasn't certainty that progress could really be made and that progress could be sustainable. And the struggle for civil rights in 1963 was very much a struggle. Peniel Joseph captures that feeling in his book, Freedom Season, How 1963 Transformed America's Civil Rights Revolution. Peniel Joseph, welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having me, David.
If I went back to 1963, time traveled, and I spoke to someone on the street, and I told them that one day there would be a national Martin Luther King holiday, what do you think they would say?
I think it depends on who you spoke to, David. There'd be people in the African-American community who would wholeheartedly agree with you and believe that that would occur one day, because by 1963, King is absolutely in his seventh year of national prominence and considered the preeminent civil rights mobilizer in the country. But then there would be a lot of other people, especially white Americans, who are critics. And the majority of white Americans in 1963 were, in fact, critics of the civil rights struggle, who would disagree with you and feel that King was unpatriotic, that he was being funded by communists. He was a subversive who was trying to really destroy the American way of life.
So we would have we would see right then and right there that there was America divided.
Absolutely. 1963, there are absolutely huge echoes of 1963 in 2025, including allegations of far right and far left extremism in the American political milieu, including conspiracy theorists who are anti-government, who accuse the Kennedy administration of running a deep state that is really anti-constitutional and anti-American, and including global controversies. The idea that America was the biggest protector of freedom in the world is cast in doubt by civil rights activists who say that, including people like Medgar Evers, who fought in World War II, and who say that they're trying to protect the United States domestically from the same Hitlerism and fascism, in the words of Medgar Evers, that he fought during the 1940s in the Second World War. So it's a really interesting time, and people are openly and publicly debating these issues. Everyone from Martin King and Malcolm X and Bobby Kennedy and John Kennedy to Gloria Richardson, activist in Cambridge, Maryland, James Baldwin, the preeminent writer of any color of the year, Lorraine Hansberry, the writer and activist, but people like William F. Buckley, Norman Potteritz, so many others are debating these issues of freedom and dignity and democracy and citizenship in really remarkable ways that year.
In light of the huge struggle that was confronting so many people saying, we can change America. This can be, we can have a different America. I mean, where did that hope come from?
Well, that is an ancestral hope. And that's one of the things that James Baldwin is able to channel in The Fire Next Time in 1963. In fact, Baldwin had left the United States in 1948, born in Harlem, one of nine children, queer, a literary genius who has to leave New York City and leave the United States to really find himself and have a chance to become the writer and the artist that he becomes. But what's so interesting about Baldwin is that he admits that early on in his career, and as a young Black boy who becomes a man, he tried to run away from that ancestral legacy because he connected it to racial slavery in negative ways and believed the lies that sort of Black people had never accomplished anything, right? And Black people just sort of lived these miserable lives and hadn't contributed to anything. And then once he got and delved deeper into American history and African-American history and even African history, he found that that wasn't the case. So what he relied on was the faith of his ancestors, the Black women and men who, even before the Civil War, during antebellum America, had been part of trying to reimagine American democracy into a multiracial democracy. And that really holds him fast. And one of the things that Baldwin argues throughout The Fire Next Time is that Black and white Americans are actually estranged kin. And the dehumanization of Black folks actually destroys the souls of white folks and the souls of the nation as well. And so he has faith in this grand aspirational republic that can finally recognize the humanity in Black people. And in doing so, white people would recognize the humanity in themselves, but they needed to do it through the crucible of confronting America's original sin of racial slavery, its afterlife of Jim Crow, but also the lies that are trafficked. And you can see this in the work of people like William F. Buckley in the National Review, who are saying Black people aren't civilized enough to have equal rights. And he's serious, he really means it. In 1963, the scientific racism of the period, the Strom Thurmonds and the George Wallaces, the Dixiecrats, but also the elegant racial segregation of somebody like Barry Goldwater, who becomes a forerunner to Ronald Reagan and the movement conservatives, the Arizona senator. So it's a really interesting time period. And the breakthroughs that are made day to day are really gonna culminate not just in the March on Washington on August 28th, 1963, but in the Walk for Freedom in Detroit, in the massive Los Angeles rally that King headlines in May, but also the activism of Medgar Evers, the public intellectual activism, what he calls witness, of James Baldwin. But we're going to see local civil rights activists like Gloria Richardson in Cambridge, Maryland, off the Chesapeake Bay in the border state of Maryland, lead a very robust and pugnacious movement for racial integration.
We're going to take a break here. We're going to continue our conversation with Pinnell Joseph. His book is Freedom Season, How 1963 Transformed America's Civil Rights Revolution. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're not able to take your calls today, and we'll be right back.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line, Peniel Joseph. His book is Freedom Season, How 1963 Transformed America's Civil Rights Revolution. You were talking about James Baldwin just earlier and his activism, his literary work, his ability to find hope again. Well, let me ask you then, though. What if we asked James Baldwin in 1963 if he thought Juneteenth would ever become a national holiday? Would he even know what Juneteenth was?
I think Baldwin might have an understanding of what Juneteenth was. He was a huge, keen observer of American history. And I think that for most of that year, Baldwin is very, very optimistic. I think something changes after the 16th Street Baptist church bombing. But for most of that year, he's optimistic. And he's optimistic because he's doing the work. He's traveling under the auspices of the Congress of Racial Equality, CORE, one of the leading civil rights groups of the time. He's doing civil rights tours and speaking tours and raising money in North Carolina and Louisiana, but also in Los Angeles and all around the country. He's at Howard University speaking to young student activists who are part of a group called the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Its nickname was SNCC, and that's the group that really mentors and cultivates leaders like the late Congressman John Lewis, people like Fannie Lou Hamer, the voting rights activist, Stokely Carmichael, the activist who's going to popularize the term Black Power by 1966, and Diane Nash, the activist who helps organize the Nashville movement in Nashville, Tennessee, that helps to desegregate that city. And Baldwin tells the young activist in SNCC at Howard University in November of 1962 that he feels their struggle, he understands their struggle, he's a part of their struggle, and that he'll never betray them, right? And so Baldwin becomes this hugely important figure as the 1960s progress, but never as important as 1963, because he serves as this bridge between conservatives and liberals and progressives and radicals and reformers. They're all reading James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time, but they're all listening to him. So he's somebody who can appear on the Today Show. He's on the cover of Time Magazine. Life Magazine does a major story on James Baldwin that spring. And of course, he meets up with Attorney General Bobby Kennedy on May 24th, 1963. And I think for our contemporary listeners, David, we have to explain the role of Bobby Kennedy, because Bobby Kennedy is more than the Attorney General of the United States in 1963. He's the second most powerful figure in the world, because he's the person who John F. Kennedy, his older brother, relies the most on for advice.
I've heard Bobby described as the evolving conscience of the civil rights movement. He started off in one place, and then as he learns more, experiences more, talks more, he changes.
He does change. And at the federal level, he is the conscience of the movement, because he's willing to take meetings and listen and speak to people in a way that President Kennedy doesn't necessarily have the bandwidth to do, although JFK evolves as well. And I think one of the exciting things of writing Freedom Season was to be able to put all these people in conversation with each other, because Bobby Kennedy, very pugnacious. Jack Kennedy called him the best organizer that he ever saw. So when you see the brothers and their relationship, it's a very intense professional relationship. Jack Kennedy didn't have very, very close friends. And in fact, Bobby Kennedy is not one of his close friends. He's his closest professional associate. So Jack Kennedy kept people in silos. He kept people in boxes. But that professional intensity is so great that they become each other's alter egos. And they can actually speak to each other without talking. It's the most amazing thing. And there's a great picture that Time Magazine has of the brothers discussing civil rights knee to knee against each other and really not saying a word to each other and almost communicating telepathically. It's really a very, very close bond in that way, really, truly remarkable. And what we see incrementally that year is Bobby Kennedy having his really Paul on the road to Damascus moment and seeing the light when it comes to civil rights, that civil rights can't be something that the administration marginalizes or fears or ducks or runs away from, but it actually has to be the beating heart of a new multiracial democracy, one that, like President Kennedy says on June 11th, 1963, should have happened a century before. Because in that civil rights address, Kennedy says there's been 100 years of delay to get freedom and dignity and citizenship for Black people, but that delay stops now.
And you put in a book also that Lyndon Johnson said something similar as vice president.
Lyndon Johnson has his best days as vice president in 1963. It's very ironic because, of course, we know that he's going to become president on November 22nd, but the world did not, he did not, President Kennedy did not. And so in May of 1963, he does a bravura speech at the Gettysburg in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, in honor of the centennial of the Gettysburg Address. And he says that we dishonor those heroic Americans who laid down their lives for multiracial democracy at Gettysburg, one of the epical battles of the Civil War in 1863, if we don't have citizenship and dignity and equality for all Americans. And so Lyndon Johnson, once he does that speech, that becomes a stalking horse for President Kennedy. And within less than 2 weeks after that speech, Kennedy makes his civil rights address. But Lyndon Johnson, you can see he's encouraging the president to use the presidency as a bully pulpit. So in certain ways, that spring, that May, June, July, after the crisis, after the first crisis of Birmingham, before the second crisis of Birmingham, LBJ becomes a pivotal figure and advisor. And there are Black activists and civil rights leaders like Whitney Young of the Urban League, who are going to eventually become very close advisors on civil rights to President Johnson, who really feel that LBJ has a much more personal touch with them and understands the problem better than JFK, only because Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, in certain ways, is one of the most intellectual presidents we've ever had, right? So certainly, when you think about the intellectual presidents, you have to say Thomas Jefferson, you have to say Abraham Lincoln, you have to say Theodore Roosevelt, certainly Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. But John F. Kennedy is one of the most intellectual presidents we've ever had. Somebody who wants to study a problem, somebody who's much more intellectually gifted than usually given credit for. Somebody who had traveled the world, including Vietnam, who's a global citizen, and somebody who's marginalized as sort of just a rich kid, a spoiled brat. And he's really not those things, actually. So he's really a remarkable figure, but it's hard for him to turn the intellectual off and go to the personal and the emotional. It's very, very hard for him. So he's distant from the problem until it becomes this massive global crisis by May and June of 1963. And then you see him give really the most passionate domestic speech he ever gives, in my opinion, is that over 3 days in June, which I say are the best days of the Kennedy presidency, June 9th, 10th, and 11th, civil rights speech in Honolulu at a conference of mayors. The June 10th American University speech, where he's talking about human rights and let's not have nuclear proliferation. And he uses the word diversity for the first time as a president. Even if we can't agree, we can at least make the world safe for diversity. He's talking about the conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union. And then the June 11th civil rights speech, where he says at one point, "We preach freedom around the world," and then he pauses and he says, "And we mean it." And it's a really remarkable speech because he's talking about the contradictions between America's rhetoric of freedom and equality globally and the stark hypocrisy of that when we think about the reality of Jim Crow and racial terror and racial oppression in the United States. And he says in that speech on June 11th, 8 p.m. Washington time, that there's a revolution happening in the United States, one that can be violent or peaceful. And he says it can't be ended by repressive police action. He says those who recognize, those who act boldly, recognize right as well as reality. Those who do nothing invite shame as well as violence. So it's a really call. He uses the term moral four or five times in there. And he says it's as old as the scriptures and as clear as the Constitution, this idea of black citizenship and dignity. So that's really the high point of JFK's domestic presidency, because it turns out it's not the Cold War that becomes his biggest legacy. It actually becomes civil rights and this idea of freedom domestically and abroad. And the global high point of his presidency is going to be that same month in June in Bonn in Berlin, Germany, where he gives those famous two, huge, huge speeches. One before a million people, the Ich bin ein Berliner speech, about as a free man, he can proudly say he's on the side of those who are being marginalized by the Iron Curtain.
So June 11th, 1963, President John F. Kennedy gives his civil rights address, calling this civil rights a moral issue, and proposed legislation that became the Civil Rights Act in 1964. Now, it's that same day when George Wallace tried to block black students from, he was blocking the schoolhouse door.
Absolutely. That same day, a few hours before, and George Wallace becomes a very interesting figure. Pugnacious, former bantamweight fighter, governor of Alabama, very famously saying segregation then, segregation now, segregation forever. He becomes the heroic, symbolic grassroots figure for a cascading counter-revolution of everyone from overt racists and segregationists to John Bircherites and right-wing extremists, to more moderates, whites, folks from Orange County, California, who are very fearful of black children wading into swimming pools with white children, who are very fearful of their home values going down if residential areas are desegregated, are very fearful of this revolution that Kennedy is talking about. So George Wallace becomes a figure who retrospectively at times is reviled, but in real time in 1963 is an incredibly attractive figure to tens of millions of Americans. And by 1964 is going to gain over 30% of the vote in the Maryland Democratic primary. By 1968, running as an independent candidate on a states' rights ticket, an openly segregationist candidate, is going to receive over 12, 13 million popular votes. So I really wanted to show in Freedom Season George Wallace's impact and his influence and the way in which the Kennedy administration, both Bobby Kennedy, who meets with him personally, and Jack Kennedy, are trying to negotiate with this figure who they understand has very, very real power in 1963 to upset the electoral coalition that barely got Kennedy over the top in 1960. And they are very fearful, the brothers, the Kennedy brothers, that they can lose re-election in 64 over a Southern withdrawal from the ticket, over the issue of civil rights. And in ways, they're anticipating in 63 what's going to happen in 68. It doesn't happen in 64. It happens in 68. Barry Goldwater is not charismatic enough of a figure in 64. And also, the death of President Kennedy really precludes the kind of political realignment that they feared, but that realignment is coming.
We're going to talk more about that when we come back from the break. We're discussing the book Freedom Season: How 1963 Transformed America's Civil Rights Revolution. We're speaking with Peniel Joseph, and we're not able to take your calls today, but this is The Source on Texas Public Radio, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Peniel E. Joseph is with us. His book is Freedom Season. Do we remember wrong about the civil rights struggle, about how it took a monumental effort to force these changes, and through protest marches, through boycotts, through public speaking, through just a mass effort of persuasion? And so do we disremember 1963 and the civil rights struggle?
Yeah, I think we do, because I think one of the things that Freedom Season shows is the difficulties, the challenges, but also the triumphs. So I think it's an incredibly hopeful and triumphant year, even with the juxtapositions against the assassinations of Medgar Evers, the six children in Birmingham, Alabama, and of course, President Kennedy. So what I was trying to show was the way in which there's really a cacophony that's happening in 63, and it's national and it's global in scope. And what I mean by that is that there's open and public debate and protest and demonstrations, but there's also hearts and minds that are being changed. There is coercion happening. Dr. King always felt that nonviolence was muscular, powerful, and coercive. But there's also people being changed, and you can see there's electricity in the air in 63. One of the parts of the book that I like the most is the parts where you see Medgar Evers is alive, and you can see the activism of Medgar Evers, who's the NAACP field secretary in Jackson, Mississippi, Mississippi native from Decatur, Mississippi, with his wife Merle, three children. But he's hosting James Baldwin and James Meredith, the first student, Black student at University of Mississippi. He's speaking on television and gives a great speech in May of 1963 about how he's a native Mississippian, and he's pushing back against notions that the NAACP are subversives, who are out-of-towners, who are outside agitators. And you see the patriotism of Medgar Evers, who's a military veteran, but you see the brilliance of Medgar Evers, who's talking about Africa and anti-colonialism and how Mississippi understands all these things that are happening in the world and demands freedom and respect and dignity for all Mississippians. Really, truly remarkable. So I wanted us to see that. New York Times profiles Medgar Evers before his assassination. I wanted us to see how Greenwood, Mississippi, in the spring of 1963 becomes one of the lightning rods of the year, and the Kennedy administration tries to actually get prisoners released, civil rights activists released, including Bob Moses, because they don't want it to become the conflagration that eventually Birmingham becomes. And I wanted us to see Dr. King in Birmingham, Alabama, on Easter Sunday in Birmingham, writing bits of what becomes Letter from Birmingham Jail. And in that letter, which is King's theory of American justice, he criticizes not just racial segregationists, but he really criticizes white moderates and white liberals. He criticizes the Kennedy administration, without saying their names, as feckless, as moral cowards, as morally reprehensible, because they're more interested in peaceful times that are rife with injustice than the chaos that comes with searching for another country and trying to build the beloved community. Really, truly remarkable. So all of this is happening at the same time. And I wanted us to see Malcolm X in Washington, D.C., calling John F. Kennedy a hypocrite and saying that American democracy is nothing but hypocrisy and full of lies. I wanted us to see Gloria Richardson in Cambridge, Maryland, who's trying to negotiate with the Kennedy administration and really losing her faith in whatever optimism she had about the new frontier, because the Kennedys seem much more interested in listening to their enemies than helping their allies and friends and their voters and supporters. All of this is happening at the same time. It's happening in Mississippi and Alabama, but it's happening in downtown Brooklyn, New York. It's happening in California. It's happening in St. Louis. And it's happening in rural areas, including places like Austin, Texas. And when we see all of that, we're able to see the momentum, but also the setbacks that happen and the crisis that engulfs the country. And you know, that year is the first year that Newsweek uses Lewis Harris to do polling
in the Black community. They send out hundreds of pollsters and they interview thousands of Black people all across the country to get real sentiment polling about race, about class, about geography. And then they do the same for whites. And it's really interesting to see the racial attitudes that are evolving, the confidence that Black people are getting in 63, the hopefulness that is happening. And you really see that high point of hope with the March on Washington. And that's really the longest chapter in the book. And the title is taken from a line from James Baldwin, The Language of Human Joy. But I wanted us to see the March on Washington from a panoramic point of view. So we see Howard Zinn, the Spelman College professor, who becomes the future author of A People's History of the United States, but who's a mentor to people like Marion Wright Edelman and different Black women and SNCC activists. Really one of the most courageous activists in American history is Howard Zinn. I wanted us to see Joan Trumpower, the young white activist who becomes part of SNCC, who's one of the only white students at Tougaloo College in Mississippi, who is on picket lines and at sit-ins where they're kicking and beating her and pouring ketchup and condiments on her, and who still believes in this idea of the beloved community and citizenship and dignity for all people. The white and Native American activist John Salter, who's a professor, who's getting beaten and kicked at Tougaloo in Mississippi. So I wanted us to see all of that, to see how is this year affecting so many different people, even as we see the through lines of Baldwin and Kennedy and these very important people, how is it affecting people at the quotidian, at the everyday level?
So to get to the point that everything happening everywhere all at once, June 11th, 63, Wallace gives his, stand at the schoolhouse door speech, and that's the same day that President Kennedy gives his civil rights address. But the next day, June 12th, is when Medgar Evers is assassinated. I mean, was that assassination, do you think, is a response to Kennedy?
No. The assassination, it's a coincidence there, but certainly Medgar Evers was being targeted by racial terrorists in Mississippi. He had gotten too big. If Medgar Evers had been allowed to live, there would have been actually more change that occurred in Mississippi. Whether Medgar Evers might have become an elected official or just stayed a social movement leader, Medgar Evers was bringing change nonviolently to Mississippi, and that's why he was assassinated. The timing shows the massiveness of the crisis, and that becomes a global crisis because people all around the world are both positive about Kennedy's great speech, but they're saying, what kind of country is the United States when peaceful activists are being assassinated in their own, right outside their own homes, for wanting equality and citizenship? And what's interesting about Medgar Evers' assassination is that the martyrdom of Medgar Evers also hastens the movement. It radicalizes people. It inspires people. So you'll see all these signs for Medgar Evers at the June 23rd Walk for Freedom in Detroit, where King does his first version of the I Have a Dream speech in front of 125,000 people. And so Merle Evers, Medgar Evers' widow, meets up with John F. Kennedy on June 19th. And Arthur Schlesinger is there. There's a poignant scene in the book about that. But the Evers assassination shows, and John Kennedy says this over the phone, civil rights has become everything, right? It's impacting everything. And so it becomes part of the symbolism and the tragedy of the time. But it really becomes very, very inspiring for people who, instead of running away and shirking, you see the Mississippi movement get energized in the aftermath of that assassination. And you see the crescendo calling us all to the March on Washington on August 28th, 1963, which really becomes the, in a way, the triumphant high point of that year. But there's more high points that come even in the aftermath of assassinations and deaths.
So King's speech, what's the brilliance of it is not talking about what they're protesting against, but what they're protesting for.
Well, absolutely. King, in that speech, and even before we get to King, Joaquin Prince, the Jewish rabbinical leader, does an extraordinary speech there. And there's so many different religious leaders who are representing a Jewish and Episcopalian and Christian and other faiths. And it talks about how Jewish folks self-emancipated and African Americans are self-emancipating. There's a great fervor there. And what King's speech does is talk about really the sight of the horizon of this country that is promoting multiracial democracy. He says now is the time to make real the promise of democracy. He talks about reparations and says we come here to cash a check that has been stamped, insufficient funds, but we refuse to believe that the Bank of American democracy is bankrupt. And so he's an extraordinary figure, and he's calling us towards this idea of a beloved community. But he also says that there are governors and politicians throughout the United States whose drips are lipping are whose lips are dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, which is the rhetoric of the old Confederacy, right? And he says we have to overcome that. And he says we're going to struggle together. But in that speech, he says we're going to have to go to jail together, right? And remember, you only have to go to jail when you're protesting for justice if you're in an unjust society, right? A just society doesn't put people who are trying to protest for justice in jail. So King is a remarkable figure, and one of the things I wanted to show in the March on Washington.
I'm going to have to cut you off here and go to break. We got to take a break here. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll continue our discussion with Peniel Joseph, Freedom Season, How 1963 Transformed America's Civil Rights Revolution. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're having a conversation with Peniel Joseph. His book is Freedom Season, How 1963 Transformed America's Civil Rights Revolution. Okay, so the March on Washington, that's in
63. That's August 28, 1963. And when we think about the March on Washington, Bayard Rustin, Black, queer, social democratic activist, mentored by A. Philip Randolph, the head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, constantly queer baited and red baited throughout his career, including in 63. But that becomes Rustin's finest moment, the organizing, setting up and facilitating all the nooks and crannies of organizing the March on Washington, which is really the most important mass public event that year. But Malcolm X comes to the March on Washington. So to show...
He calls it the farce on Washington.
He calls it the farce on Washington, but Malcolm is really of two minds because he's still impressed that all those people came out, especially the Black people. There's about 90,000 white people there, altogether a quarter of a million people there, but the crowd is majority Black. And what's so interesting about even Malcolm's critique of saying it was all organized by the Kennedy administration, that wasn't true. The Kennedy administration did try to stop it, but King and Rustin and Randolph knew that they needed to have this march and this demonstration. So the march didn't do the massive civil disobedience that some people wanted. But I think the march was very, very effective in what it did do, which was bring the whole country to a mass church meeting and really help refashion a new civic religion around American democracy with racial justice as the beating heart of American democracy. And there's a point in that chapter where I show that, John F. Kennedy, at one point when he sees the march gathering from the White House, he talks to the White House butler, Bruce, and tells him that he's for the march and he wishes he could be out there with the people. He greets the march leaders and greets King with the words, "I have a dream." And they have sandwiches and talk about what they need to do. But then he issues a statement talking about what a remarkable march it was, and it was peaceful, and it's in the best of the American tradition. So that's a really important high point. And you can see from January to August, all the evolution and the transformation that has been made And so that summer is a huge, huge high point. The low point is going to be the autumn with the 7th, September 15th and the murders of four girls at the 16th Street Baptist Church, and then two boys that same day. And those young people, Carol Robertson, Addie Mae Collins, Cynthia Wesley, and Denise McNair, three were 14, and the youngest, Denise, was just 11. And then a 13-year-old black boy named George Peanut Ware is shot by a couple of white Boy Scouts because they said they just wanted to see what would happen. He's shot and murdered. One of them served 6 months in juvenile detention, and the other nothing. And then a 20-year-old young boy, young man, is murdered by the police, shot in the back, Johnny Robinson, all in one day in Birmingham, September 15th, 1963. And those deaths of those six children are going to change Jimmy Baldwin. They inspire him to help organize nationwide demonstrations the following Sunday. And he leads and speaks at a march of over 7,000 people in Foley Square, outside the federal building in Foley Square, Manhattan. And one of the people who's listening to him is Malcolm X. And Baldwin is talking about a political revolution, and so is Bayard Rustin by that point. So the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing really changes and transforms the tenor of the movement in ways that we hadn't seen previously.
November 22nd, 1963, we have the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas. He recently embraced civil rights as a national cause and moral issue. How does that assassination enter into all of this?
Well, that assassination, we usually think of it now, 62 years later, as a foregone conclusion. I think one of the things I try to show in Freedom Season is just how shocking that was, even as people like Malcolm X with the famous chickens coming home to roost, but then Baldwin, in a really even more excoriating way, connect John F. Kennedy's assassination to the racial terrorism that we've seen throughout the year against the children in Birmingham, against Medgar Evers, against other people as well, who just are not famous and as iconic. And so what's so extraordinary is how we mourn Kennedy's death together, but we grieve separately for those children in Birmingham and Medgar Evers. And that's where Baldwin starts to do a massive indictment
Right, he's saying
of
everyone's grieving for
Americans.
John F. Kennedy, but where's the other grief?
Exactly. And that so in a lot of ways, it's stunning, it's a shock. And what the nation really decides to do, and this is where Lyndon Johnson's political skills are very, very important, is Johnson tries to convince people successfully to tell a different story about Kennedy's assassination. And that different story means saying, and King says the same thing, that we need to pass civil rights as a memorial and to honor JFK's legacy. So you're passing the 1964 Civil Rights Act in a way that if Kennedy had won re-election in 64, maybe it would have taken even longer to pass. Maybe that Civil Rights Act doesn't pass till 65 or 66. And so he becomes this incredible martyr figure, but it's a very contested martyrdom, right? So James Baldwin is at Howard University after the assassination saying, we're going to continue to demonstrate. And John F. Kennedy was not the great civil rights leader that many people are going to say he was. He was somebody who was groping, who had good days and bad days. He says the same thing about Bobby Kennedy. So what's so interesting about the Kennedy assassination, it provides an ending. It provides a kind of closure, and it provides new beginnings too, because the death of the president who becomes this singular figure during a high point of America's second Reconstruction is a very, very difficult thing to explain to people. And what does this mean even globally? And I think Baldwin does the best job of trying to explain what it means. But the death of the president shows that America came undone and remade itself in 1963. And through the leadership of Lyndon Johnson, for the next 2 years at least, we're going to embrace civil rights nationally as a moral and political good. And we're going to see that in the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act. There's still going to be huge roiling demonstrations, but we're going to get these two singular pieces of legislation that really the Civil Rights Act endures, but the Voting Rights Act at its strongest is going to survive from 1965 to 2013 and the Shelby v. Holder decision. So what we see with 63, in summation, it starts a 50-year racial justice consensus period between 1963 and 2013 that, despite its flaws, and there's still going to be racism and mass incarceration and all this stuff, you're going to see Black people and women of color and historically marginalized groups gain the most access that they've ever had in the history of the Republic. They're going to build the most wealth, have the most elected officials, go through and graduate from K through 12 public schools and private schools, but also higher education, corporate America, have the most home ownership, have the most ability to go to racially integrated schools and racially integrated neighborhoods than in the entire history of the United States, which is going to be 250 years starting next year. So that's why 63 becomes ultimately so important.
Martin Luther King is Time Magazine's Man of the Year 1963. Was that significant?
Oh, absolutely. In a year where the president is assassinated, to say that Dr. King, and that was Time Magazine's first Black Man of the Year, really signaled something really big. Henry Luce's publication, to put King on the cover, shows us that things are changing and that the civil rights movement is part of this national and global narrative of American identity and citizenship, freedom, dignity, and democracy. So it's a huge symbolic moment, King's Time Magazine Man of the Year.
And it was a major institution of the press. It saw the future.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the press does an extraordinary job, I think, in 1963 of the Black press, the white press, of narrating and documenting this year, because it's an incredible year, and it's a year that really shakes the foundations of the country and plants new roots and new seeds for the future that we're going to see and experience.
What's happening right now? DEIA going away and all this other stuff happening. This Voting Rights Act, basically not even what it was. I mean,
Oh, absolutely. We're in post-consensus America. So in a lot of ways, we're back to where the country was before 63, where racial segregation, non-citizenship, the marginalization of historically underrepresented groups is it's
legalized
open season.
discrimination.
Legalized discrimination, absolutely. So part of the lessons of this book is the coalitions that are required to achieve that consensus, but also an understanding that even after consensus is achieved, it's not permanent. You have to fight and struggle for it. And that's something that these activists and this group of people knew. They weren't looking for safe spaces. They were looking for courageous spaces where they could talk about all these different issues. And they weren't afraid to get their feelings hurt. They were the men and women in Teddy Roosevelt's arena. They weren't afraid to get their feelings hurt, and they helped to change the course of American history. But that course that they helped to change is still continuing, and right now that legacy is our legacy, to push forward into the future.
Peniel E. Joseph is the author of the book Freedom Season: How 1963 Transformed America's Civil Rights Revolution. Thank you so much, Peniel, for talking to me today.
Thank you, David. I enjoyed it.
That's it for this edition of The Source on this Juneteenth. I'm David Martin Davies. Thank you for listening.